Hello, my finest friends. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Here's a joke from my son. What did the bum say to the other bum? That's a bummer. You know, not for everyone. Look, thanks to everyone who's come to see the previews of Can I Have My Ball Back? It's been going really, really well, and I'm really pleased with how the show's turning out. It's officially on tour now from Wednesday. I'll be at the Leicester Square Theatre. A couple of tickets left. Lots of press coming to that one. It'd be lovely to sell out, but there are a few other London gigs not selling as well. So if you're going to come to London, maybe look up those other London gigs. And then this week I'll be in St Albans on Thursday, Gloucester on Friday, Chorley on Saturday, which is sold out, but you can join the waiting list, and Glasgow on Sunday. Two shows. I think the earlier show is sold out. Check with the venue, but the later show has some availability. Come along if you can. If you enjoy these podcasts and like them being free, then the great way to pay me back is to buy a ticket to a show or buy a download or a book from gofasterstripe.com. But you can just keep listening for free as well. That pays me back also. So, you know, no pressure. But I'd love to see you there. If you just know me from the podcast and don't know me as a stand-up, I'm pretty good as a stand-up. It's a good show. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's only made about seven men faint so far. So, you know, are you brave enough to take the challenge? Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy whichever podcast you're listening to now.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to another Rahana Stuffer Book Club. I'm very excited to be joined by Stephen Mangan, who is going to talk about his intellectual book, The Fart That Changed the World. It may be aimed at children, I'm not sure. How are you, Stephen?
I'm terrific. How are you?
I'm very well as well, thank you. We know you as an actor, Stephen. You're a world-renowned actor. You were Postman Pat in Postman Pat, the movie, for Christ, for crying out loud. That's how good an actor you are.
Well,
What? You don't need any. Alan Partridge shouted at you across the car park. You're a world-renowned actor.
Right, okay, I'll take that.
What prompted you? This is your second children's book, I think I'm right in saying. What prompted you to move into writing children's literature?
I've always wanted to do it. And I have always been slightly... I mean, you know, sometimes you meet sports people or models or singers who say, oh, I quite fancy doing a bit of acting. And part of you goes... It's not that fucking easy, darling. You know, I went to RADA for 3 years. I trained. You know, you can't just turn up and switch lanes like that. Who do you think you are? And of course, annoyingly, some of them are really good at doing it and effortlessly move from being swimwear models into acting or whatever it is. I suppose I've always sort of felt that writing is... it's a very rarefied gift that very few people have, and that I probably wasn't qualified and wouldn't be able to do it. And I wouldn't, and I would be one of those people who would, I would be annoyed by myself by going, stop leveraging your sort of whatever fame you have to sort of elbow your way to the front of a different queue. You know, stay in your lane, mate. But then you eventually get old enough and you think, sod it. Why not? Why, you know, I'll never know till I try. I may turn out to be absolutely terrible at it, in which case everyone will gleefully tell me, and then I can carry on being shouted at by Alan Partridge in the car park or whatever it is I'm doing. So I tried it. My sister, who is a very fine artist, graphic designer, she's spent many years kind of she's done a lot of sort of graphic design, actually a lot of cookbooks and, you know, doing drawings and stuff for that. We were talking about this and she said it would be great to do something together, maybe. I thought initially, yeah, what about a picture book? Because there's not many words in a picture book. And I thought maybe I could knock it out in a couple of days. And she would do all the drawings. And she said, no, you should write a book. And I'm glad she did because, yeah, so I ended up writing a 50, 60,000 word book, Escape the Rooms, which was the first book we did. And I enjoyed the process, even though who knew it was such hard work writing? It takes forever.
It is. It's very difficult. Writing a book's hard. And these books, I've dipped into Escape the Rooms and I've read The Fart That Changed the World. And they're both quite high concept ideas and not very nice ideas. Escape the Rooms, from what I can gather from what I read, is about a boy who is persuaded to take a bungee jump that makes him go underground and have to go through a lot of challenges to escape an underground sort of, I don't want to say dungeon exactly, but an underground entertainment complex of escape, which is a, what gave you that? Did that come from doing a bungee jump and thinking you were going to go through the ground? It's a lovely imaginative idea.
It actually came from our other sister, my youngest sister, Lisa, who was at a fairground in the West Country, I think. And she got on decided to do a bungee jump. She got onto the crane and there were two sort of lads who were running this thing. And, you know, if you've done a bungee jump, you'll know you wear a kind of harness around the lower part of your legs. So they fitted her with this harness. And as the crane was going up, the two of them were sort of looking quizzically at the harness and then they'd whisper to each other. No. And then my sister was like, what is there a problem? And they're like, no, it's fine. What's that supposed to be like? And this went on and on, you know, all the way to the top. And she got to the top and you put your hands on the sort of bar and then you basically fall forward and it gets to a point where you get to a point of no return and you're out and you're gone and you're falling. And just as she got to that point, one of them went, no, oh no, wait. And she fell 300 feet through the air going, what?
Oh no.
And it was just a wind up. It was just a wind up to heighten her adrenaline, which was, you know, totally unnecessary. Cause if you've ever done a bungee jump, you know how ridiculously terrifying they are. So I she told me that story and I had this image. I thought it would be a great start to a film, actually, when I first thought of it, about someone high up, the wind whistling, someone standing on a crane, them looking out, being terrified, falling out of the crane. And instead of stopping and being pulled back up again, just plummeting straight through the earth. I think in the book, I said it's like a bowling ball into a vat of jelly. You know, so it's not like a hard thump. It's just something going thump. And he's underground and suddenly he's in a whole different world. And of course, when you write anything or when you have a creative thought, you always think this is entirely original. But I've realized since it's pretty much the same beginning as Alice in Wonderland.
A little bit, yeah. But
she follows a white rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah, into another world and there's all these weird creatures and stuff below it. But that was the beginning thought, the misfortune of my younger sister.
That's great. That's it's a really good origin story for that story. And I love it as an idea. I think, you know, it sort of reminds you of Alice in Wonderland rather than being the same as. I think it's a nice thing. We just picked up the Fart That Changed the World and I've been reading it to my daughter at night, and occasionally my son, who's a little bit too young for it, listens in as well. But again, this is quite a high concept because you've created sort of fantastical kingdoms and kings and different warring factions between this country in the middle that sort of brokers and keeps these two enemies apart. So it's quite a high concept again, but it's essentially about someone letting off and how that affects the history of that of those countries.
Yeah, letting off is a good euphemism. Yeah, they fart. The king farts. Yeah, the king farts very early on in the book, it literally changes the world. I mean, as the title says. I quite like writing for a king and a queen and a kid. I think the issue I found with writing primarily for a British audience is that we are so not divided, but you know, you are placed instantly in this country by where in the country you're from, what social class you are, you know, what sort of school you go to. And if you're writing about 12-year-olds and, you know, and they're your sort of heroes, I just thought it was easier to sidestep all of the British, oh, they're from the south, or they're from the north, or they're, you know, they went to private school. So I just thought sidestep all of that and set it in the world of kings and queens and in sort of nowhere land that could be anywhere. The original idea for that was the butterfly effect, you know, the idea that one little event can cause another event to happen, which causes another event. And eventually this small first act causes something huge. Even though the actual butterfly effect is sort of about the opposite of that, as far as I understand it. But anyway, I thought it was quite interesting when you're writing about children or for children, the idea that even though they may feel that their actions don't have an impact on the world, how interesting to think of it in another way, that their little small acts can actually end up causing huge world-changing events to happen through a series of, you know, of chain reactions. So that was a starting point for that.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's very much about consequences. I mean, it's that sort of sliding doors thing without showing the other side, which is what all literature and films are about, is sliding doors without showing the other side. But I think sliding doors would have been better if it had been about Gwyneth Paltrow maybe farting outside the train or farting inside the train, and the consequences of that. That would have been, I think, everything would be improved by starting with a fart, I think.
If she'd farted before she got on the carriage after she'd got on the carriage, because if she'd got on the carriage and then farted, everyone knows it's her, and that would lead to Paltrow pandemonium. But if she farted before, she could probably, I think that it would have been better.
She'd probably sell the fragrance of the fart and make millions of pounds out of it. So we probably just helped Gwyneth Paltrow there, but
fart
never
candle.
Mind.
Yeah.
it's trying to avoid class and all that sort of stuff, but the book is actually quite a treatise on why monarchy should be abolished, really.
I mean, sure, but if you set it somewhere that isn't specifically modern Britain, you can kind of, I'm just trying to abolish the monarchy. That's the only reason I became a writer. I'm an Irish, you know, I was brought up in an Irish family, and we had a family meeting when I was about 12, and they said, one of us has got to abolish the monarchy. And I put my hand up, and I've just left it a bit late. So here I am.
It's good. I think this could be, it's amazing if a book about a fart could destroy the monarchy. But that's, so what age children do you, my daughter's 7.5 and is enjoying it. And I don't know if that's the lower end of the,
I would say that's the lower end. I would say, you know, depending on, what sort of level reading, 6, 7 would be, oh crikey, would be the lower end. And then up to, I don't know, 83, 84, I think higher end. I mean, everyone loves a fart joke.
I think so. It's enjoyable. It's a very funny book, and the characters are recognisable without being, you know, I don't think we've exactly seen them before, but you immediately get into the characters. I think with both these books, if you've based them, you've got three sons, and you've based both these first two books, or at least named the major character after your first two sons, but not your third yet.
No, well, my third son is Jack, and he was the hero of the first book. He was a baby when I started writing it, so that name was on my mind, and I just put it in as a sort of placeholder name, and then it became the name. It had to be the name. It just sort of stuck. It didn't feel right with any other name, so I thought, oh, God, I've written the hero of the first book and named it after my youngest son. I've got two other sons. I've got to write at least two more books. So Frank is the hero of the fart that changed the world. How happy he is to be the hero of a book with fart in the title, you'll have to ask him. Okay. I'm currently writing the third book, Harry, which his name actually appears in the title of the third book. In fact, I finished chapter six this morning. So he is going to feature as well. But Harry's now 15, so I think he's probably at that age where he doesn't really want to be highlighted in a children's book. He'd rather dad didn't bring the world's attention to him, but yeah. Tough luck.
Well, listen, it's a nice thing to do. Your Frank is also, which I presume the baby Jack was not exactly the inspiration for if he was a baby, but your son Frank is quite as the character is quite a sort of imaginative, playing games and making up stories and stuff. Is that right?
He is. I think all kids do it, but Frank's still doing it. He just turned 12 not long ago, and you'll still hear him upstairs in a room running around, sort of fighting imaginary things. And I mean, he's going to love me saying this on a podcast, but you'll see him in the garden pulling down a branch and talking into the branch as if it's a walkie. You know, he's still got that really vivid imagination. He draws cartoons and stuff, and he's a genius. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. He's some kind of child.
Well, there's a lovely character in the book, and the character's thrown in. I mean, essentially, without giving too much plot away, I don't think many 12-year-olds will be listening to this podcast, and this is more for the parents anyway. The butler who is really the person who runs the country takes the blame for the fart that the king will not take, and the queen is so upset that she imprisons him for a day. And so even though there's another butler who also ends up in the dungeon, Frank ends up having to go from the kitchen where he's imagining being fighting sharks, basically, into trying to keep the country that he lives
from
in
rack and ruin
existing. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a very likely scenario that I think many 12-year-olds will find themselves in. I mean, that's the thing about writing children as heroes. You have to somehow, you have to handle the fact that the adults, you know, you have to work out why they don't just ask their parents or the police or somebody to do it for them. What is the issue? Why are they kind of fighting this particular problem on their own or with other children? So once you get that kind of set up, you're away. But, you know, I'm trying to write funny books with a lot happening at quite a high rate, because I know children, you know, my only children, their attention spans can be short, and they're not like adults. They won't pretend to be enjoying something just to be polite. They will just drop it and not pick it up again. So, I'm writing to make myself laugh and hopefully have enough of a turnover of jokes and excitement and situations to keep the kids interested, children interested.
I think it is. And I think what I liked about it is, you know, you sometimes you don't quite know what's going on, especially with Frank. You know, it's sort of my daughter's going, What's happening? Why is this guy suddenly underwater or whatever? And you kind of go, well, I don't know yet. We'll have to work out. We'll have to find out why we suddenly jumped to this. But there's a lot of characters and there's a lot of incidents. And people come back in and go back out again. So, your kids have to be wrapped into it to concentrate on it. But I certainly found my daughter was very much into it. And my son enjoyed the farting. So even as a 5-year-old, I think it might be a 5-year-old might be a little bit too young to keep up with, but it's also because it's about big issues and it's about tiny issues, and essentially, you know, it's essentially about the fact that everybody farts, and so the idea of being upset by a fart is quite hypocritical, presuming the queen also farts, and it's hypocritical for her to be cross about it, and it's weird to be embarrassed about it. And I think even that, even if the book was solely about that, that's such an important message to get across. Because I remember, thinking you'd get into such trouble as a kid if you farted. But I knew that I farted a lot. I still do. I've done one during this interview. And it's luckily we're on Zoom. But
oh yeah,
you know, you felt shame about it because you were made to feel like you were it was just you were a stinky little boy and everyone else was pure, and so it's nice just for that, isn't it, to get
and I think maybe it was particular to me, but I think a lot of childhood, you know, growing up, is trying to work out if you're weird for feeling and thinking the things that you feel and think, and that are you somehow doing being a human wrong? You know, have you got the? Does everyone else know what they're doing, and you're the only person thinking, I haven't really got the hang of this yet? You know, so that's why there's so many adults in my books who are idiots, frankly. You know, or in positions that they shouldn't be in. Like nearly every ruler in every book so far, I mean, in the third book as well, should not be, you know, in the position of power that they are. Because
it would be nice if that was just in children's literature that was happening.
I wonder why that's on my mind at the moment. You know, we just you just look at this parade of hopeless, clueless, you know, twats who are kind of in position of power, and I don't know. You just want to say to children, it's okay. You know, the first book was sort of about how it was more about bereavement, really, that escaped the rooms, and how, you know, the feelings you can have when you're grieving can feel really odd. And, you know, you sometimes think, oh, there's a sort of right way I should be doing this. There's a sort of a proper way to grieve, when in fact, of course, there isn't. And it was sort of trying to say to children, you know, the emotions you might be going through, you know, give yourself a break, basically, you know, just don't, you know, you've got enough on your plate without worrying whether you're doing the grieving right or whether you're being the right sort of child. You know, there's enough going on in the world. There's enough coming at you. Give yourself a break. Stop self-criticizing. Stop worrying, if you can, about, you know, how you're approaching life. So that is the kind of, you know, I suppose, they say you sort of write, all writers write one book over and over again, don't they? So maybe that's the book I'm destined to write. Don't worry if you think you're weird.
That's absolutely perfect. And it is such an important message to get across. And I think using humour, and, you know, these are funny books as well as, you know, touching on important issues. So, and, you know, on big issues and little issues, and that's, you know, that's absolutely perfect, because getting that reassurance, realizing that someone else might disappear into a fantasy land or might be embarrassed about farting or whatever it is, or be going through something, you know, big like that, but losing your a parent, which is what is part of the first book.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Something I personally really liked about the Fart That Changed the World was just pointing out the weirdness of, you know, of having animal heads on the walls of palaces and stuff. We went on holiday to the Isle of Arran. We went to Brodick Castle, and it's just like the hallway is like there's probably 200, and they're all stags' heads just all over the place. And you kind of think, what the is if that was if that wasn't a tourist attraction, you'd think it was the house of a serial killer or something. It's such.
Well, I mean, it is the house of a serial killer. That's exactly what it. You know, I mean, if you went to someone's house and they had 20 human heads sort of that'd been preserved on the wall because they were people that they'd shot, you'd run a mile. But somehow having animal heads is a thing, and there's a restaurant that we sometimes go to with the kids that has a few sort of wild boar and deer heads on the wall, and I always just think it's so weird.
And so the
king is especially sensitive to it and doesn't understand it, but it's his, you know, he had a sort of toxically masculine dad who liked shooting animals for fun. It's like all those ridiculous pictures you sometimes see on the internet of people standing, you know, sort of very out of shape men who couldn't probably run 5 yards without, you know, having to have a break, standing over the dead carcass of a magnificent lion or an elephant, you know, just because they've got a gun and a few quid. What are they doing? It's just exactly. Weird.
It is weird. And I'm surprised that things haven't changed, you know, that someone hasn't gone, all right, well, maybe they did this in the past, but let's take them down.
I mean,
it feels really weird.
The argument now is that these people play such a premium that they can go to countries that desperately need money for conservation, and they are killing supposedly, you know, populations that need to be brought down anyway for some other reasons. But, there may be an economic argument for it, and there may be no other way, but it doesn't stop it being really distasteful and really unpleasant and really weird.
No, well, again, but I think, you know, you cover it in a funny way, but I think, again, that it's just, you know, I think, again, as a kid, it'd be nice, you know, if you've been a kid and you've been around somewhere like that and just thought, this, why are they doing this? Just to hear somebody say, this is a bit weird.
It's quite
nice. I don't know, when we were looking around houses, when we were moving, like a couple of people, you know, we're looking at some older houses, and a couple of, you know, people, it actually just put you off the house. You know, just one stag head on the wall. You couldn't get beyond.
They're,
you know,
murderers.
You knew that wasn't good. It wasn't going to be there when you took the house. But no. I don't want to be in a house where there's.
Where's
been
the rest
a dead
of that animal?
Animal
yeah. I mean, I now realize that this, having written the first six chapters of the next book, I think I'm basically using these books to have a go at all of society's things that I find deeply weird and unsettling. I mean, one of the characters in the next book is deep into sort of New Age mysticism and, you know, all those sort of snake oil type things that I just, yeah, and astrology and all that stuff. So, yeah, maybe I am just using it to have a go at groups of society that I disapprove of. There must be an easier way to do that than writing a book, but there we go. That's the path I've chosen.
I think there's a bit of you in there, and I think that's not a bad thing. Was it in terms of getting the book published? Was it an easy ask? Did you go to a publisher and they said, "Of course, we'll take your children's book"?
They obviously they wanted to see an idea and some of Anita's artwork and because I'm an actor and on the telly and therefore have access probably to PR, I can get on radio interviews and TV interviews to promote the book. Unfortunately, you know, very annoyingly for everyone else who's slaving away in this industry and trying to get a publisher and get a book published, it was pretty easy for me to do that. Obviously, you'd hope that the books have to have some sort of quality. I mean, I'm very proud of them, and I'm very self-critical, as you could probably gather from the conversation we've had already. I give myself quite a hard time, so I wouldn't carry on unless they thought they had some merit, but it's not really for me to say. But yeah, the short answer to that question is it wasn't too difficult. No.
Yeah, but presumably, you know, you wouldn't. But if it was terrible, or if people weren't buying it, you wouldn't be at the point where you were writing your third and fourth one.
You wouldn't be, but there are various different, you know, there are terrible books written by, you know, celebrities in inverted commas. They are terrible and they sell. And there are, but I suppose the fact it feels like I've opened up a whole new career that I love, that I really am into. I've started turning down acting work in order to write. Because I enjoy it so much. So yeah, I wish I'd tried it earlier. I wish I'd done it earlier, but there we go. That's the way things have worked out, and I'm loving it now. I am.
I mean, I think it's very. I think the publishing industry can be snobby, and writers can be snobby. But I sort of quite strongly believe that more people should be writing books rather than less, rather than fewer. I mean, it's, you know, it's that you want to get those voices out there, and that really, I mean, it's the same with acting. You know, anyone could have a go at acting, and a lot of people might not be very good at it, and some people might get through and. For different reasons, but you know, I think with writing, because it's such it's not up there on a stage, it's not up there on a screen, it's such a small thing that you can get pleasure from it yourself. I think it's an important thing to process things for yourself, but equally, I think it's something that most people wouldn't even try because it's quite hard, and obviously it's then hard to be successful. But if you give it a go, there'll be. You know, the people that I think have written the more interesting things are often comedians who would never have got a book deal for any other reason, but will end up, you know, going in. And someone like Limmy, I don't know if you know Limmy, but he's the kind of guy who would never in any other circumstance get to write an autobiography, but his autobiography is therefore really interesting and different, and you know, it's a really important voice, I think. And so, you know, I think no one should feel bad about trying to write. No one should feel that they're not allowed to write. It's something I think everyone should be allowed to do. And if people want to buy your work and want to read your work, then that's sort of the bonus, really, I think, on top of it all.
Yeah. I mean, and also, you know, having three sons who are, I don't want to sound like I'm 100 years old, but, you know, when we were young, there were three channels on the telly, and you know, they were off most of the day, and there weren't computer games, and I did read, and I absolutely loved it, and it was the sort of, I was obsessive about it. I mean, I would read during, you know, family meals. I would have the book next to me. I don't know why my parents let me get away with that kind of behavior. That's awful, but you know, I always had my head in a book, and I absolutely loved it. And it sort of breaks my heart that my own children, it's much more of a struggle to get them to read, because they've got so much else going on that's sort of easier to do. So anything that gets kids reading, in my eyes, is good, because I got so much pleasure out of it. I want them to have that similar sort of pleasure. So whoever's books they're getting into, and obviously for one generation, it was all the Harry Potter books. That was the sort of gateway start for a generation. Below us, I suppose. But yeah, so I, you know, yes, more books the better, the more people reading the better, I don't know how to finish that thought.
But I think books being funny as well, I think that's a great, and it's certainly, this is a bit of a generalization because it's not just boys, but I think it's a really good way to maybe interest boys, that there's someone's written a book and there's fart in the title, and maybe books aren't quite as stuffy, or, you know, I remember, I mean, I was always into stories and I loved writing stories, but I remember finding it really torturous to get into a lot of the books that I was expected to read. And I sort of liked Snoopy and stuff, and my parents were really upset because I was reading cartoons and because I was into comedy, you know, so it was sort of about who I was. But yeah, if a funny thing came along, and whatever you think about David Walliams, I think he's attracting in a lot of readers, you know, and a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily read books. And I think this is, you know, to have a book called The Fart That Changed the World, it's a great title, because it's immediately what? It's funny. And
how?
What? How? How? And so you want to know. And, you know, we're sort of about halfway through it reading with my daughter, because we're working on a few books as we go. But I was... Obviously, I wanted to read the whole thing before this, but I was actually quite wrapped in working out there's a plot in there, there's a mystery in there, there's a question of who's trying to screw things up. So it does pull you towards the end of this book in terms of finding out what's going to happen and finding out what the repercussions are going to be for everyone. And it's all fun and funny but that's a great thing to have. So, you know, you can tell that it's a book that the author has taken some care over. I think you can tell it's sometimes these books aren't written by the person whose name's on the cover, Stephen. I don't want to shock you, but I feel like this one is written by Stephen Mankin.
What? Yeah, oh yeah, it's definitely written by me. I mean, I also think that comedy is the best way of examining life's most difficult and profound and troubling and unpleasant, you know, situations, tropes, you know, the things we have to go to of being human, death and farting, the two unavoidable things. But, you know, I do think comedy is the way in because I think while you're still laughing at something, you're still engaged with it. You're still on the road, you know. I've been not being very, very articulate, but I just don't think there is a subject out there that you cannot in some way deal with using comedy. And I think it invites an audience in because a comedy is kind of, you know, you're sharing a joke with a reader. When you write a joke that someone reads and they laugh at, there's a connection between the writer and the reader. You are both laughing at the same thing and you both understanding the same thing and why it's funny. And I think from that connection or through that connection, you can explore all of life's messy and complicated and difficult subjects. So, and plus, I just, like you, I just, comedy was always something I responded to. And you know, you're always looking for it, not in every necessarily in every single moment, but I think the best plays, the best films, the best books ever written all have a comedic element to it. Hamlet's a really funny play in parts. So to me, it's a sort of essential part because I think a life or a book or a film without comedy it's missing such a vital chunk of what it is to be a human being and to interact with other people. So without that element, I'm suspicious and hostile to those art forms.
So what I think what you're saying there is this book is as good as Hamlet. I think that's what you, that, I'm glad that's what we're going to put.
That's not for me to say, but if you want to, I mean, I did hear you say that. That's fair enough, Richard. I respect your opinion.
You can put that as a cover quote.
If you want.
It's got a king, it's got a father who's haunting him.
Through dead animals on the walls.
Was it fun working with your sister? I mean, it's obviously nice to keep things in the family, but is it? I can imagine sibling rivalries could be a difficult thing, but or are you sort of past that?
The joy of the setup is can't do what she does. I can't draw at all. And she has no desire to write anything. So we definitely have our completely separate skills or areas that we're bringing to the project. So I think that really helps in that I'm not going, can you just give me the pencil? Let me just, I'll put a nose on that character. Or the hair should be like this. I can't do it. So I'm very happy to leave it up to her. And of course, she's only a year younger than me, Anita. We grew up together and we spent our childhoods trying to make each other laugh. So we have a very similar sense of humor. I don't have to explain jokes to her why something is funny. I can put little things in that only she gets. And I can trust her to kind of get the joke and then enhance it with the drawing. So I just don't think in that way visually. When she's, you know, occasionally I will say to her, you know, Father Changed the World, the cook, I thought, oh, she might look like Miriam Margolyes, or I wanted the Queen to be like, is it Fenella Fielding in Carry On Screaming? Because she's got this sort of death fetish and wears black. And so, you know, occasionally I'll give her a reference like that. But on the whole, I'm happy to let her, you know, do her thing. And she's happy to let me do my thing. So it's a very harmonious working relationship.
I think it's nice to be at that point where a book and where the, I think there should be illustrations in every book, really. But there is not. I think it's really enjoyable. Again, the kids going through the book are really enjoying the pictures. The, you know, you'll read them the story and they really want to look at the pictures. And I think it does sort of add. It's not, it, you know, it adds a whole new level, I think, to it. But it does also it helps focus the attention on the book because, you know, kid, my daughter will. She somehow picks it all up, but when I'm reading a story, she'll be sometimes dancing around the room and I'm going, am I wasting my time here? Am I you listening to this? And then she'll come back and go, oh, this is like that bit in that, you know, so she's listening to it all, but it's great to get them into the book and go look at the funny picture of the cook or whoever. But yeah, it is nice to have that. So it's a good thing to have.
Yeah, and also, there is an audio book. Yeah.
Yeah. Go tell me about what you said about the pictures.
Well, I was going to say that the pictures set a tone, I think, for what kind of book it is, you know, the style of the pictures, you know, let you know how seriously you should be taking or, you know, how daft the book is or how moments are actually, you know, I think it just reinforces. I mean, you know, you talk about David Williams's books, you know, those, the artwork in those is, I think, very cleverly chosen to kind of echo Quentin Blake, which makes you feel, you know, oh, Williams is kind of in the sort of Roald Dahl sphere, you know, and I think that those pictures do give them a lot of help and, you know, are very useful in that respect. And I think the pictures Anita does in my book, they set the tone and also, you know, give you something to cling on to when you think of a character. Plus, it's also good fun to write scenes that are really difficult to draw. For example, in the fart that changed the world, I one scene set in the dining room with the animal heads on the wall, I talk about how there were, you know, 40 place settings and 40 chairs, and every place setting had loads of knives, forks and glasses. And if you look, she's had to spend about a week drawing this room with 40 place settings in it. That's the thing an older brother can do to his younger sister. There you go.
There it is. It's a beautiful picture. And also the animals have wearing party hats and they've had their mouths attempted to be pulled into a smile, which hasn't obviously quite worked out. So they have to be
to look like they're enjoying themselves because he's so freaked out.
And every different, all different animals. So yes, well done on that. So say, tell me about the audiobook. I want you didn't read the audiobook yourself by the sounds of it.
I did actually read it myself.
Oh, you did? Okay,
I just don't think I'd have been on. I find, I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I do like them a lot. In fact, I'm listening to the Alan Rickman diaries at the moment. And the, you know, the person you cast to read a book is so crucial. They've made a very strange choice in the Alan Rickman diaries. Not the fault of the actor, obviously, but just I don't know why they put this particular. I mean, obviously, Alan Rickman has got a very particular voice. You're never going to find anyone who sounds like him. But yeah, I don't do many audiobooks because they are mind-numbingly and really, really difficult. You know, you spend especially if you do adult books, are several days in a recording studio. And it's really hard to keep your concentration and to keep going. And you always get to one sentence, you have to have 15 goes out because you can't, the words are just swimming in front of you. So for that reason, I kind of stay away from them because I think there are other people who are sort of better at them than I am. But I couldn't let anyone else do these books. Having said that, I'd often get to bits and think, oh my God, what does this character sound like? I have no idea what this character sounds like. and have to sort of make it up on the spot. But, you know, audiobooks. I did years ago, Tamsin Greg and I did some fairy tales if they were giving them away free in the newspaper, might be the Saturday Guardian or something. And I think that's one of my favorite jobs I've ever done. I did Rumpelstiltskin and I used to play those shamefully to my children. Occasionally, if I was going out for the night, I would put the CD on and press play and edge slowly out of the door as, I mean, but until they were about eight, they thought every story started with "Read by Stephen Mangan." So that's a shameful thing in my past. But yeah, it was, you know, I couldn't let anyone else do the audio books.
No. Well, I very much enjoyed, it's a book with lots of characters. So if you are reading it to your kids, if they're not reading it themselves, there's lots of fun to be had in coming up with voices, which is something I enjoy. My kids are still just at the point where they still allow it and they still find it okay. I actually, your publisher actually sent me a copy of, as Escape the Ridge sent me The Baddies by Julia Donaldson and Axel Schaefer, which I read to them one night and then they wanted the next night. And I said, oh, should I do the voices again? And they went, yes, and really excited. So I felt really happy that for a very small window in my life.
My 6-year old is now going, just read it, Dad. Just read it. Because I'm doing that. And he's like, Dad, just. And he gets really upset. There's even a hint. I just try and slide just a small hint of an accent into a character. He's all over me. So enjoy it while you can.
I will enjoy it while I can. Well, look, it's a terrific book. Are you reading anything yourself at the moment you'd like to recommend, or any books you've read recently? Like to recommend?
I've just read Night Ship. Okay. I'm just looking around to remember who's written it. Jess Kidd, which is a really interesting book it's set on ships, which I normally stay a million miles away from any book set on ships because I just have a fear of cruises. I just feel they're like being locked in a hotel you can't get out of. But it's a sort of dual part story set in the 17th century. A sort of Dutch girl is going to Indonesia on a boat, and then also in 1989 where this young boy is on an island, and it was really I enjoyed that was really good. Just read Hamnet as well by Maggie O'Farrell, which I hadn't read before, but what a great book. Talking of Hamlet and my book being better than it, just thought I'd remind everybody.
We should. Well, look, it's lovely to talk to you. I wanted to ask you, I'm sure you get asked this all the time, do people still shout Dan at you in the street on a regular basis?
Yeah, all the time. I did the marathon a week or two ago, and I got more Dans than Stevens on the way around. In fact, a couple of days ago, walking through Soho, I heard a couple behind me going, is that Dan? Is that Thomas Dan from Alan Partridge? And at that moment, someone about 40 yards in front of me shouted, Dan! And they went, oh, it is him. So, yeah, I get it all the time.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because it's like, it's not even your catchphrase. You're not really in the scene. Were you even there when they were filming it?
I wasn't there when he was filming it. I mean, And also, when it first happened, because the whole point of it was you have to keep shouting it and he doesn't hear him. So so I remember going into a record shop in Camden, and the guy behind the counter just started shouting Dan at me. And he did it for about 30 seconds. And what can you do apart from smile and wait for him to stop? There are worse things people can shout at you.
There are worse things. I'm sorry, but it's also, you know, it's funny when it's not happening to you. But anyway, look, Stephen, I think I'm looking forward to cracking on with Escape the Rooms, and I love the fart that changed the world. So do buy that, everyone. You know, I don't think you even have to, but, you know, you can be an adult and buy these books, and I think you'll still enjoy them. I think when you get a proper funny, my wife reads kids, writes kids books, and I really, really enjoy them. Jen, you would never read them if you didn't have a kid or if your wife wasn't writing them. But I think it's, you know, don't read them on the tube, probably. I was going to take this one. I was sort of trying to finish this one, and then I was thinking of reading it on the way. Way somewhere in a cafe, and then thought people might think I'm a bit weird if I'm reading a kid's book, you know, without a kid there. But maybe you just put it in self-conscious.
No, you shouldn't put it in a copy of Playboy or something and hide it.
The lesson of the book is, you know, don't be ashamed of who you are, and don't be ashamed of your bodily functions. So
it's for farters. Anyone who farts should read this book.
They definitely should. It's hopefully all of us. I hope it is. I hope you have the pleasure of farting at home. Thank you very much for joining us, Stephen. And thanks for talking to us. I'll see you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs for all of the information on the tour. GoFasterStripe.com for lots of downloads and books and lots of fun. Thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Tell your friends about the show. Tell your friends about the tour. I love you all. I'm out.